Hi,
Hello.
Calvin. Calvin, we were just talking about the relationship between tetrionic particles and electromagnetic fields in tetrionics. And you just started to explain how that link works. And I'd just like to formulate a question at that level, because you have already addressed that in the past. And you said, well, whenever you have a particle, the longer it exists in time, the larger its field will extend. And this is where I still try to grasp how those fields associated with the particles are based on that particle in the ambient field around it, but also how the pre-existing ambient field around it will interact with those particles.
Yep.
Yep, we'll talk a little bit about electrical engineering terms in this case, mainly antennas, things like that. But the basics are, well, as I keep saying, are straightforward in tetrionics. One of the problems that quantum mechanics has, and it won't admit, or QED, more so than even quantum mechanics, QED, the most successful quantum theory of moving charged particles, electrodynamics, has a number of assumptions that are built into it in order to get the answers that it gets. Its claim to being the most accurate is based on the fact that it gets the exact answer that they're seeking. And that's easy to fiddle the math if you know what answer you're looking for. And that's exactly what they've done. No apologies to the quantum theorists out there and the mathematicians that are now jumping up and down and screaming. That's all that's happened in QED. They looked for a value and they then set up the physics to do it. And one of the big problems that came across early in the piece for Richard Feynman was the problem of infinites popping up, because part of the mathematics, they have to put infinities into the mathematics because these fields propagate out through all space over time. And it doesn't matter whether you're a second away from it or a million years or 600 million years away from it, these fields keep expanding and they keep interacting with particles around them. This is how particles know where to go. Yet another problem that Richard Feynman touched on. But once the infinities were put into the mathematics in order to get the correct answer, to 12 decimal places, I might add, they then had the problem that the mathematics to get the right answer was full of infinities and they didn't know how to solve it. Well, they knew how to solve it, but they didn't know how to get rid of the infinities. The lay explanation is called renormalization, and it works basically like this. If there are infinities in the mathematics, it's because we are saying the universe is so vast and the time periods are so great that we need to express it somehow in the mathematics. So we use infinity to express that it's a big number, finite but unknown. It's a terribly huge number. If you take infinity to mean what it really means, you need infinite amounts of energy in order to create these fields and maintain them. The solution that Richard Feynman came up with in consultation with a number of others was to renormalize the equations. And it's a fancy way of saying that they said if there's an infinity there, there must be a negative infinity, so that the infinity and the negative infinity cancel out and are no longer in the equations. Voila, they don't exist anymore, and we still maintain the right answer to 12 decimal places. Now, one of the values they were seeking and refining was the alpha constant, with the value of the inverse of 137, and that's probably the most well-known quote by Richard Feynman. He talks about the hand of God. The biggest mystery, as he put it, was that the hand having written, he basically says that there's some unknown creator or mechanism creating the universe exactly as we see it. And the fine constant's one of them. But having written this number to its exact proportions so that it is maintained, it's as if there's no reason as to how it's maintained, or as he put it, the hand having written the number no longer exists. It vanishes. So this magical number comes out in the constant, which relates all the other constants together. And they have no way of explaining how the universe got so exactly and precisely balanced, so finely tuned, as they put it, for all the constants. Well, the first thing I'd like to bring up is that the constant number that they're chasing, 1 over 137, is wrong. It should be a 1 over 132. The reason why the number changes, that there's a number of factors, but the biggest factor is that their value for the rest mass of an electron is wrong. It's out by about, I think it's 3%, 2.9%, mainly because all the calculations are done from experimental data, in which case the electron always has some electromagnetic field or kinetic energy, etc. It's never an electron at absolute zero with no motion, no chem fields, no BEM fields. Well, it wouldn't have a BEM field, no EM fields. Tetrionics lets us look at particles and model them as though they were at absolute zero. And then we develop the field models of how they create their fields, where the energies come from, and we account for each and every Planck quanta in the calculations. They're not heady calculations. They're simple classical forms, not even really algebraic. There's a little bit of algebra, but there's nothing much in it. 12 Higgs bosons create the particle. Then mass times velocity squared is the chem field, half of which is kinetic, half of which, the other half is magnetic. So all these basic things, they're all classical Newtonian sort of equations, easy to understand, even easier to draw now that we have the geometries. But it brings us back to this question, where does the fine tuning for this number come from? And more importantly, the big dollar question is, how do electrons sitting stationary in space develop and maintain that field? How do they create the electrostatic field around them that expands out into space in order to communicate information about themselves to other particles and communicate information about other particles in space to them? Because as Richard Feynman put it in one of his lectures, he went to great lengths to say this, even though we have the mathematics to describe the paths and the interactions that the electron supposedly intuitively knows, the electron in reality does not have those equations. There is no supercomputer inside each and every electron that's brought into existence. The electron somehow knows over huge, vast distances where each and every particle in the universe is, charged or not. In reality, they're all charged, even the neutral ones. But it knows where each and every particle is in order to affect its course. Well, it doesn't literally think about which way it has to go. It responds to the fields emitted by the other particles. So where does this energy come from? Because if it's sitting there and it has no kinetic energies, it's just sitting there as a point particle, it's radiating a field, an electrostatic field that communicates information about its charge, its mass rate, its mass charge ratio, its shape, its velocity. All these things, all these properties, as we've discussed in other lectures, are communicated instantaneously to other particles around it. It's not like a particle has to wait 1 second before it knows where the electrons move to. It knows at the moment the electron moves. It knows the moment the electron gets a bit more velocity and it reacts accordingly. Or the electron with more velocity will react to the other particles. The information flow is two-directional. But if it's stationary, there are no kinetic energies. There's no forces being applied to it, yet this electrostatic field still exists because it's one of the fundamental properties of an electron. The electron has an elementary charge of minus one. Tetrionics shows us that the minus one is in fact minus 12, which reflects the 12 Higgs bosons or charged fascia of each electron. But that still doesn't explain how this energy to maintain this electrostatic field is there, because if it was just an initial amount of energy and then it released that initial, the field would get weaker and weaker and weaker over time as the field spread out. But we don't see that occurring. If the electron's sitting there, it always has the same value strength field per measurement of radial distance from it at all times. It doesn't weaken. It only weakens as inverse square of the distance. But the field strength at the set distance does not diminish over time. So it's somehow got some internal power source or intrinsic energy, some power supply that maintains this electrostatic charge field. QED resolves this quandary by bringing into existence virtual particles, where energy is borrowed from the vacuum energy to create a messenger particle that communicates this information to the other particles at a distance. So it says, I need to tell the photon, the proton sitting on the moon, that I'm about to move slightly, or I've gained some velocity. I do this by borrowing some energy from the vacuum of space, creating a messenger photon, which interacts with the proton sitting on the moon and says, this is what this electron is doing. And then the moment it's communicated the information, again, renormalization kicks in, and the particle vanishes. Its energies are released back into the vacuum energies from whence it came to balance out the equation. A bit like your checkbook. Energy borrowed, money borrowed. Energy paid back, money paid back. A neutral ledger. But that's just a mathematical trick. It doesn't explain anything about the mechanics. And that's what Maxwell was quite adamant about. If you can write a mathematical equation to explain some physical process, you must be able to build a physical model. Here's where I have an advantage over most physicists, because I have a background in electrical engineering, radio transmissions, etc. One of the tricks that you can use, if you imagine firstly the electron as an antenna, the central axis has, even though when it's stationary in tetrionics, it shows that the central axis has north and south magnetic dipoles. They're arranged along the axis and they're arranged on the edges of the leading edges of the three tetrions that make up an electron. But the ones along the axis are important because they're concentrated along the axis as magnetic dipoles. So you have three of them in the center there. What they do is they act as a tiny, tiny antenna. If you apply electrical currents to them, it'll because of the structure of the electron, I won't get into it in this discussion, but the energy received will excite it, will enhance the magnetic dipole, make it oscillate, etc. We can't measure those oscillations because of the structure of the tetrions is such that when the energy is applied, the individual dipoles increase, but they're also any attempt to measure them will be neutralized by the sheer fact there are an equal number of north and south dipoles in the structure of an electron. But these central axis ones are key to solving what's going on. Within the structure of the electron itself, we had the 12 charged fascia. That's the initial charge, the elementary charge, or 12 quantum charges, 12 Higgs bosons, however you want to term them. Although modern physics still hasn't caught up to the fact that Higgs bosons are charged bosons, like every other boson. They still say that they're neutral. Wrong again. This the stationary electron has an inherent 12 quantum charges. That's the charged surface of the electron itself. The amount of quanta in those charge fields determines its mass, but the geometry is always the same, as illustrated in those pictures. Now again, energy per light second, or energy divided by c squared, is a measure of mass. Energy divided by c to the fourth, or light second squared, is a measure of the energy of the matter in the electron. So in order to measure the topology of an electron, you need a light second squared spherical coordinate system. So you're measuring the matter. So it's energy divided by c squared, which is that first illustration 2509, relating to leptonic self-energies, or where the energy of electrons come from. The energy within the charge topology is the inherent energy of the electron. It's what gives the electron weight in a magnetic field. Now, if you accelerate the electron, and this is basic tetraonics 101, nothing changes about the energies in the electron's topology. It always, once it's created, it is exactly that mass every time. What changes is the energy in the chem fields. Where does the chem field orientate? Well, as you can see in that illustration, we've got positrons as well as electrons. But the energy, just as it does in the mass of the bosons that make up the particle itself, the energies are stored as Planck quanta in the radiant EM field of the electron. So any electron in motion will have a chem field, as I call it, a kinetic EM field, pointing in the vector direction of motion. And that's in addition to its elementary charge of its topology. So you have the minus 12 plus this chem field. The chem field is what radiates out. The chem field and the arrangement of Planck energy momenta within that field is what communicates information about the electron to other particles around it over time. And in particular, it communicates the charge, how much mass the particle has, its direction of motion, its linear momentum, its kinetic energies, all this sort of stuff. All the stuff that are important in QED are contained in the information that chem field provides to other particles. And just as the electrons radiating the chem field, protons radiate their own chem fields, pointing in their vector direction. If they're standing still, you have an electrostatic field with two chem fields pointing in either direction, where the linear momentum of both field, which is just the square root bisector, the line down the middle, the arrow that points in the vector direction of motion, cancels out, because there's one pointing one way, another pointing the other. So whereas this illustration here on 2509 has a chem field pointing in the direction of motion, a static or a non-motional electron will have a EM field, which, remember, is a diamond shape, not an equilateral. It's two equilaterals back to back, the shape of a photon. It's an EM field. It's an electrostatic EM field, because what you don't realize is that the magnetic dipole of both negative charge fields pointing in both directions neutralizes out, just as it does in the electron itself. So you can't measure, again, you can't measure the magnetic dipole that's present, but it is present, because if back to back, even you have a north and a south back to back with each other, if you try to measure that north field or the south by bringing in a north or a south field to try and attract it, the north-south pair will equally push and pull from whatever pole you bring in. So you won't get a reaction magnetically by trying to sense through Hall effect or any other measurement device that utilizes magnetic sensors. You cannot measure the magnetic dipoles that still exist. QED say there are, and relativity says that a stationary elementary charge like the proton or the electron or the positron have no magnetic moments. Tetrionics show that they do have magnetic dipoles, and a neutral or a neutralized, not so much neutral, but neutralized magnetic moment. So sitting still with the two chem fields back to back, you have a radiant EM field, an electrostatic field, because you can't measure the magnetics, but you can surely sense the negative charges of both chem fields going in both directions to make it a static field. So hence why when you're talking about the point particle electron stationary, you talk about it being an electrostatic particle. And when it moves, you say that it suddenly has this property of a magnetic moment. If you look up the basics of electrodynamics, a stationary electron has no magnetic moment. A charged particle in motion, or a charged electron in motion, has a magnetic moment. This is the founding question that brought about special relativity. This and the initial point that I brought up are what created quantum electrodynamics that Richard Feynman built along with others. It's all tied in together, but if you don't differentiate between charged matter topologies with their EM fields in the Higgs bosons and mass energy fields, as in radiant energies around particles, you can't begin to grasp the actual mechanics. In the illustration, as I said, as you can see in 2509, if the electron in this case on the right hand side moves or has a force applied from the right, it will move towards the left as shown. Once it's moving, it's not just a 12 pi negative charge topology, but it also has this negative chem field. And you'll see that that negative chem field, not the electrostatic, but the chem field, has a distinct north and south magnetic dipole. You lose the diamond shape and you get an equilateral shape. So you go from a EM field, diamond shaped, to a chem field, equilateral. And that chem field gives you all the information about motion, etc., because the charge hasn't changed. The charge remains exactly the same. And this is what the quandary is in quantum mechanics, in QED. Because if the charge hasn't changed and the particles' mass energies haven't changed, except for the Lorentz contractions, haven't changed, when the particle's at rest, you take away the chem fields, the Lorentz contractions, etc., you're left with this particle. It hasn't got anything else except its own mass, yet it radiates this field, the EM field, the diamond-shaped one, which is probably better illustrated on the next illustration, 2510. You can see the two electrons moving in both directions, and you can see the chem fields that they have. But when it's stationary, as in the center bottom illustration, you have the opposing chem fields, or the EM field, which has cancelled linear momentum, as I said, but it's still a radiant field. It's radiating out from the electron, telling it, hey, here's my charge, I'm negative. It's proportional to the mass energy of the electron, so it's saying, this is how big I am. And it also tells them that it's not moving. So the other particles around it can react to this field. how does the electron that's sitting there with no forces applied, no chem energies, nothing like that, no magnetic moment of its own, create and maintain this electrostatic field as it radiates out? Because we've observed these particles, even sitting as still as we can get them in modern physics, they don't appear to lose any mass. And tetrionics backs that up. Once the particle's created, the electrons, the mass of the electron's topology, matter topology, does not change. But this field still continues to radiate out and is maintained. How does it do it? It does it through a trick that you see in electrical engineering, particularly in radio communications, etc. When you create an antenna to receive a radio signal, you tune it to precise lengths, and you can see half wavelength, quarter wavelength there on that illustration. So tetrionics now gives us a picture of the EM fields that are created by radio waves, etc. What we need to do now is find some way to capture that energy from the space around the electron and use that energy to maintain the electrostatic field around the electron. There's a trick that electrical engineers in radio communications know, but it's not commonly known amongst other engineers, etc. It's called a resonant field. Tesla spoke about it, etc. What you basically do is, if you have an extremely weak signal, one of the tricks you can use as an electrical engineer to improve the capabilities of a small antenna to receive that signal, even if you've mistuned the length, is to apply a small DC voltage or a charge to the antenna. In doing so, it creates a field. It amplifies the field and allows you, as you change the voltage, to increase or decrease the number of quanta in that radiant field, the field that the receiving antenna is now transmitting. And what you do is you change the energy levels to a point where the antenna itself creates a field that is better matched to the signal it's trying to receive. Most people won't fully grasp what I'm saying there, but the electrical guys and the people that have had experience with antennas will. By applying that small voltage, an antenna that's either poorly matched or not very well suited to the task, or simply receives a signal that's too weak, can suddenly have its performance improved. And it's sort of contrary, because most people think, well, if you're now turning a receiving antenna into a broadcast antenna, isn't that going to start, particularly on the frequency you want to receive, isn't that going to interfere? And the answer is, at low power levels, it doesn't. If you ramp up the power levels, it will interfere with the signal you're trying to get. It increases the noise to signal ratio. But at low levels, the field that you're creating is only sufficiently there to do what's called probably the best term I can think of is a near field tuning or resonance with the signal that you're trying to receive. So you adjust the voltages, you make the receiving antenna broadcast, and basically what you're doing, as per that illustration at the top, is by increasing the number of Planck quanta in the field, you're creating an electromagnetic field around the particle. And when it matches the signal it's after, it tunes to it. And then you can receive that signal far more efficiently. And in the electron's case, you tune to external fields, which can be any frequency at all, really. All you need is a small EM field to start with, and then it will automatically couple to similar wavelength fields around it that receive. It won't couple to all of them, but it will couple to the specific frequency wavelength that you've created through the applied voltage and harmonics. And the harmonics obviously transfer information less efficiently, but you're still receiving the energy of that signal. Remember, a received radio wave is just an oscillation of electrons that have linear momentum and kinetic energy, etc., magnetic moments. So by coupling with them, coupling one field to the other, in the case of the vacuum energy, which is full of differing wavelength frequencies, the moment you create the electrostatic field, as shown in the middle at the bottom, you create a field that can resonantly couple with the same or harmonic frequencies in the space around it. And that then gets focused where it follows the field, the scalar fields, as you can see at the top there with the electric and the magnetic. You've got electric, negative electric field and a magnetic dipole. The electric field is tuned right back down into the center of the electron's central axis. So it broadcasts, it creates a weak electrostatic field around itself. This then couples with the EM fields of the vacuum energies or the ether around it. And it then, the field then, its electrostatic field then focuses those tuned wavelengths back down into the center of the central axis, which is right at the middle in the block wall of the magnetic moments that are sitting across the electron in the center of the antenna, just like every good electrical engineer would want. You want to focus the electrical signals back into the focus point. What do they do when they're back in there? Well, electric becomes magnetic, and the field then, the received field can then amplify or add energies to the weak broadcast electrostatic field. So the moment the electrostatic field is created around an electron, the moment it's brought into existence, this its EM field begins to broadcast. As it's radiating out, it's coupling harmonically in resonance with the surrounding vacuum energies, which then gives it energy that it can broadcast back out. This is the same path that mass energy takes within matter, where the electric cycles through the tetrion's topology. Electric becomes magnetic. Electric goes into the magnetic block wall, radiates or strengthens the magnetic, which radiates at 90 degrees out to the edges, where it then meets electric fields, and you get this Mobius loop that you're always talking about, Otto. It circulates around and around and around. But in this case, where the chem field or the EM field draws in the energies, they hit the central axis and they radiate back out along the planar fields of the EM field. And that maintains, that gives energy to the radiant electrostatic field. So suddenly there's no mechanism inside the electron to power these or maintain the electrostatic field. The electrostatic field is maintained by the fact that the electron has an electrostatic field in the first place. It's a bit like the have your cake and eat it too scenario. The moment the electron's created and it's motionless, the electrostatic field's created. The electron itself has EM and electric fields, which are neutralized within themselves, so there's no magnetic moment to measure, but there certainly are magnetic and electric fields in existence within that structure and within the fields that radiate out. Those fields, as they radiate out, are maintained by the vacuum energies, which I forget the number, 1 by 10 to the 150 times greater than all the mass in the universe, the ocean of energy that surrounds and fills our universe that gave birth to the particles and the fields that we talk about, these equilateral Planck quanta. There's far more of them, 100 by 150 orders of magnitude, in the ether that we can't detect than there are in all the visible matter in the universe. So there's ample amounts of harmonics and resonant frequencies for that chem field to interact with. And as the field gets larger and the wavelengths of the Planck quanta within the field's stretch or redshift, they still couple with frequencies that are out there because all the vacuum energies are, again, light and heat that's been radiated by matter since the creation of the universe. Every frequency you can think of is out there, long and short wavelength. All the electron has to do is, along its central axis, create a tiny, tiny electrostatic field to act as an antenna and to create this couple or this resonant chem field that I talk about, or EM field, doesn't matter which one. The chem field actually enhances the effect, but when you create a chem field, even though you're enhancing the EM field, it's very unidirectional. It's in the direction of the electron's motion, the stronger field. You lose homogeneous, well, there's a word for it in antenna talk, omnidirectional, it's gone, it'll come back. You lose that generic blanket electrostatic field in preference for a linear Yagi, which is the chem field. But the Yagi is still tuned to various frequencies. Any EM field, any low voltage EM field, which is all a chem field is, will still have a frequency that it's tuned for and harmonics of that, and they will exist within the vacuum energies. So this idea of virtual particles goes literally poof and vanishes. We don't need the virtual particles anymore. We don't need renormalization because in tetrionics, the third law of tetrionics is that there are no infinities. There is not a single infinity in tetrionics. Tetrionics is a discrete quantum theory of the universe. There is no need to renormalize. There's no Heisenberg's uncertainty. Everything is made up of discrete equilateral triangles. So there's no role for and no need for infinities in the mathematics. We know that there are only a finite number of everything, particularly Planck quanta, that go into making everything in the universe. So we must model and describe them mathematically as finite, not even very big numbers. You can do the math on the fields if you want. It's just the energy of the field divided by Planck's constant or divided by the frequency of the chem fields tuned for resonantly to give you Planck's constant. But if you divide by Planck's constant, the number of quanta, you have the frequency that it's related to. These fields propagate at the speed of light. So the frequency is related to the tuned wavelength through the speed of light. Speed of light equals frequency by wavelength. So simple bit of algebra, and you can quickly calculate the resonant and the tuned frequencies that the chem fields are ideally suited for. And they're only tapping into a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the energy that's in store in the universe that we can't see or normally sense. And it's massively greater than the energy stored in the matter, as I said. So we get rid of renormalization, we get rid of infinities, we get rid of virtual particles, we correct the fine-tuning constants value from 137, or inverse of 137, back to the inverse of 132. We explain how electrons are made using tri-tetrion topologies. We explain how they're made out of electromagnetic fields that become matter. And even though we can't, we never will detect the magnetic dipoles in the charge topology, they exist all the same. We explain the field geometry when it's standing still. So as I said, even though that the electron, we can only detect the electrostatic fields, there still exist neutralized magnetic dipoles in those fields and in the topologies. And we make use of those dipoles to broadcast a or to generate the electrostatic field in the first place, and to convert the resin and the harmonic electromagnetic energies that the field can synchronize with back into energy to maintain that field. All of that's done, and in the same process, it obviously completely undermines quite a few tenets of QED and relativity, because relativity's explanation for the magnetic moment of a charged particle like the electron that has none when it's moving is that the particle itself becomes distorted, remembering of course that relativity is like most modern theories of physics, quantum physics, that says the electron is a spherical particle which has got a electric charge evenly distributed all over it with no magnetic moments. So it's just a pure electric field or electric particle. Where does the magnetic moment come from? Well, Einstein took Lorentz corrections, which says that basically the faster something goes, the shorter the wavelength. Well, actually, he says the shorter the length becomes. In fact, it's just the wavelength of the chem field, not the particle itself. But Einstein ignored that because he didn't differentiate between mass and matter, and said when an electron in this case goes from standing still as a sphere and begins to move, it gets squashed out of shape. Its length in one direction, the direction of motion, is contracted. So as the if you imagine the electron being a sphere instead of the diamond-shaped topology I show there in the last illustration, 2510, if you change that diamond shape into a sphere, as the chem field, as the electron moves in one direction, the spherical shape of the electron becomes shorter in the direction of motion, contracted, as they term it. But in contracting that sphere, the mass, energy, and the charge remains, so you can only conclude that the particle itself is being squeezed out at the sides. It's like putting a walnut in a vise. As you start to compress the vise, the walnut gets shorter and shorter in one direction, but it starts to spread out in the other directions. That spreading out is what relativity says is the magnetic dipole that suddenly appears from nowhere. Tetrionic shows us that it was always there and it was neutralized, but when the chem field or the energies of motion were applied and the chem field was created, we then had a EM field with another north-south dipole, but that north-south was not neutralized, and that's the magnetic moment, not this changing of the particle. In fact, the electrons took charge, mass, energy, topology, the shape and the weight of the particle never ever changes. No matter how much you accelerate it to the speed of light and beyond, to infinity, as Buzz Lightyear would say, the electron always looks the same, weighs the same, and has the same electrical charge as it did when it was created standing still. Tetrionic shows us that the measured extra mass and energy, momentum, of the electron as it moves faster is completely contained within the chem field. And you have a fixed geometry of the chem field. As you add more energy to it by applying forces, you're packing more and more quanta into that chem field. As you apply the more quanta into the same physical shape of the chem field, you must compress the quanta. You have to, if you want to put 4 quanta into the one triangle, they must be compressed to half their size so that 4 of them can fit into the original size. They must become a quarter of their original size, which means their wavelength is a half. You can see that in the physical geometries. It's the wavelength that contracts with Lorentz contractions, not the matter itself. So where you see Lorentz contractions talking about length contractions, you must always change it to wavelength contractions, which means as you apply a force to the electron to make it go faster, the resonant and the harmonic coupling of those chem fields changes in proportion to the velocity of the particle. But once these particles are established and they've radiated out, say an electron is created on Earth at CERN, within 1.3 seconds, that electron has broadcast all the information about its mass, its charge, its direction of motion, its kinetic energies, the force applied, the linear momentum, its magnetic dipoles. All that information is transmitted to each and every proton and other electrons and neutrons to within the orbit of the moon. 1.3 seconds is all it takes to establish that field. Once the field's established, it harmonically couples with the vacuum energies to maintain the field, to keep supplying that information to all other particles. If you apply a force, you create the chem field. The chem field then just says, hey, this particle's moving in a specific direction, and it couples specifically with the vacuum energies in that direction, like a directional Yagi as opposed to an omnidirectional antenna or omnidirectional field. But all these problems of QED that are swept under the rug or renormalized out of the way are explained rationally through basic electrical engineering techniques. There's nothing secret about them. You'll find them in the electrical engineering books. Look for I don't know what the terms are, but look for overcoming low signal strength by powering the receiving antenna, things like that. And you'll see articles written by many, many engineers that have done exactly that. In order to the signal to noise ratio of a weak signal or a mismatch, if they apply a voltage, turn the receiving antenna into a broadcast antenna, albeit very, very weak broadcast antenna, and adjust the voltage in order to couple with the desired signal. And that's all the electron does. The universe, if you want to describe God, there's two words I'd use. Firstly, he's a geometer, the creator of the universe. He set and tuned all the constants through an equilateral geometry. The constants are constant because they're all related back through these equilateral quanta geometries. If you increase the quanta over time, let it radiate out, the proportion of electric to magnetic stays the same. Therefore, the fine-tuning constant stays the same. And every particle you create, every field you create based on these equilateral quanta are constant. All the values you measure, the electric to the magnetic, the linear momentum to the kinetic energies, the fine constant to the Dirac's constant, all these things to Planck's constant, they're all related and they're all constants. Even the speed of light, they're constant because they're all derived, they're all a geometric relationship to the geometry of Planck's constant itself. The geometry isn't hidden. It's termed in modern physics as quantized angular momentum. You hear it referred to as spin, curl, flux, charge. All these properties are just re-expressions of something they haven't seen. But the quantized angular momentum is square meters per second, or as I say in tetragonics, equilateral meters per second. That's what fine-tunes the universe, the fact that you start with a triangle, a geometric shape, and no matter how you stretch and pull it, or let it expand over time, or compress more of them into one spot, they are always equilateral. They don't become isosceles, they don't become right angle. They're always dual right angles or equilaterals, and that's what's been ignored. Once you know that, that the creator or the source of the universe is these equilateral triangles, the constants make sense because they're a geometric constant, and the textbooks refer to them as that. They're geometric constants, even in the maths. Secondly, the creator of the universe obviously is an electrical engineer, because in designing it, and he used electromagnetic fields within the equilateral triangle, he knew that the charge would have an effect to bring fields together to make matter, and that the matter can then be motivated by energies in the fields, that these fields can resonantly and harmonically couple to the total energy of the universe that was unused in creating matter to power these fields forever and a day. And if you think about it, even though the electron's the ultimate cake and eat it too, because even though it's created the electrostatic field to reach out into space to couple with the vacuum energies then give energy to the chem field, which radiates back out into space, which couples to the vacuum energies, which then give it energy to the electron, and on it goes ad infinitum, not to infinity. It just is a perpetual, not a perpetual motion, but a perpetual energizing circuit. As soon as the electron's created, this field is established. When it's not even moving, the moment it moves, it's just enhanced in the direction of motion. But it's an unseen and unrealized component of electrical theory in tetrionics that I don't talk about a great deal. I've put the slides in there in QED so that the more astute people that think about it and have a bit of electrical engineering knowledge can look at it and begin to comprehend what's going on and understand it. But it's really just a small piece of the puzzle. But it does reinforce that the electron has a certain role in the universe, and its role is to act as a rotating rotor, poor choice of words, a spinning rotor, the equivalent of a three-pole rotor in our electrical machines that Westinghouse and Tesla built. They are very good at storing energy and releasing it as and when needed. And it's, the more you get to know tetrionics, the more you will see components or facets of electrical engineering coming to the fore in how the universe was designed. Even the deuterium nuclei, the building block or building component of all elements and atoms and compounds and biological life, the deuterium atom is a synchronous quantum converter with a rotor in it, behaving exactly as the same as the devices that Tesla and Westinghouse built to store and release electrical energies. And that's all an electron does when it's bound to bound in the atomic nucleus. It absorbs incident light and releases it as spectral colors. All these things, these facets of electrical engineering come to play in tetrionics. And I think the greatest stroke for me was the fact that I had a background in electrical design, etc., so that I had some basic training to think about these things as electromagnetic devices rather than just spherical atoms or spherical electrons. Because when you look at their electrical capabilities, their electrical design, you see that more than ever that the universe is a manufactured environment. It's certainly changed from the images I've always had as a child up until recent years with tetrionics as a organic sort of evolving system. The universe is an engineered environment that is eternally, dynamically evolving and circulating energy either as mass into matter or matter into mass. It's just endlessly cycling around and around. Energy in all forms, mass and matter. And the interactions between these fields create all the motion that we see. So those that get to know a bit of electrical theory will see lots and lots of things buried within tetrionics. This is just one of them. I'll pull it up there. If you've got any other questions, Otto, I'll happily elaborate or explain what you need explained.
I'm very glad that you put this whole understanding of the antenna function into the picture. In looking at it, basically as I was trained to do in engineering, that part of the antenna function just doesn't come into play. So by reminding me that that is the core of tetrionics, then of course a whole lot of understanding falls in place again.
That's good.
That also was what I lost out on, seeing that relationship between the electromagnetic field and the charged particles of tetrionics. Basically, that's where you have that link between the basically misunderstood principle of gravity, which is the displaced vacuum energy pressurizing on each tetrion and each composite structure of tetrions. That all of these particles, like little boats, float in this cosmic ocean of called the Dirac Ocean of the ambient electromagnetic energy called the vacuum energy, and by that pressure exerted onto the surface of these charged tetrions, there is that conversion, and it's really good to be reminded that these surfaces are let's call it short-circuited electrodynamic electrostatic loops. So that those are the active units which already are able to convert that ambient energy and work with that, give a direction, use that energy functioning, and you're referring to the charging up of an antenna by a small electric field. Of course, adds a whole deeper level of understanding in which the attuning of the antenna is basically also the tuning of the field, which much more clearly shows that there is this interaction between matter and mass energies, that the antenna and the field are much more closely connected. And of course, from the perspective of healthcare and bioorganisms and living, you can then see that there is this connection which we find in the body, that the living organism is in fact able to ingest energies from the environment, charge it up within the system, as a result can put that charge on the antenna, and as a result can tune into the environment. So in what you just explained now, there is also this whole foundation of, let's call it, the energy metabolism, which is used by every cell, essentially already every spore, every fungus, every virus, every microbe. And then when systems become larger, they just have more internal circulating energy, as a result of which they can better condition the field within them, between them, which is also what you described as the chem field and the BEM fields in the ongoing story of tetrionics. So for me, what you spoke about today was very much a gap in my understanding. And basically the gap in the understanding was that I forgot to identify that concept of antenna dynamics into the story.
Yeah, don't feel so bad because I've been at this for 8 years and I've looked at it from many, many directions as part and parcel of it. So I have the advantage that I had the disadvantage of having to develop the theory. So I had to look at so many interactions and create a huge depth of understanding in order to explain these processes. And like I said, I was very, very fortunate that I had this background in electrical design work, because a normal physicist or a mathematician wouldn't be aware of these processes, wouldn't think of the electron. I mean, like, even if they had designed the basics of tetrionics, one of their biggest stumbling blocks would have been the shape of the proton and neutron, as it was for me. But yeah, when you suddenly see them with the electron in it, acting as a synchronous converter, and in my mind, the light bulbs went off big time. I could see how these things plugged together then as batteries, how there were series and parallel connections, how the energy came in and went out. This resonant field tuning is just a tiny piece of knowledge that I happened to possess that enabled me to go, look at that. These things can be tuned, and if you think of them as having a small field that then can couple with the larger field surrounding it harmonically, then you can draw energy, which will then supply energy. You can circulate it around and use it in many, many ways. And of course, even though, like your initial comment with the greater than and less than arrows pointing outward or inward, these EM fields, all EM fields, have bidirectional positive and negative charge quanta pointing in and out. So that's the basis of why Coulomb's law of interaction, as I call it, works. Why opposites attract and sames repel. It's because of these quanta, and it's the same thing. Once a field is created, it's a bidirectional communication field. It not only allows the electron to sense what's around it, but the particles that field comes in contact with can then transfer information back to the electron. They can sense what's around them. They can get the information from the other particles' chem fields. But instead of imbuing electrons with some super quantum computer or some mystical ability to create virtual particles, none of that happens. All that happens is basic geometry. The electron is completely dumb and inert. There's no organic or sentient life within it. It simply fields the push and pull of these fields. And it uses these fields and their wavelengths to draw more energy, to maintain the fields. And this communication goes on, and that's how Newton and Coulomb's force laws work. There's no time component in either Newton's laws for gravity or Coulomb's laws for charge interaction. They operate over any distance in the universe at near instantaneous speeds, but there's no explanation for it. And that even though people like to say, oh, well, QED and special relativity have resolved things back into classical theory, that remains a huge problem. Because classical theory has no time component. Relativity and QED are strictly limited by the speed of light. You can't have your cake and eat it too, which is what they're attempting to do by saying that QED is the most successful theory and explains so much. It's a piecemeal solution that doesn't understand what Maxwell sought, and that is the basic physical model or basic physical mechanics of what is going on. The model of the topologies, the mechanics of the fields, mass versus matter again. While we continue to formulate mathematical treaties with no differentiation between mass and matter, you'll always get strange results that may or may not gel with practical experimentation. but it'll never make sense, and you certainly will never unify relativity with quantum theory with classical mechanics like tetrionics does. It's the geometry that's key to all of this. It's the single postulate on which tetrionic is built, and that is that Planck quanta have equilateral geometries. If that fails, tetrionic folds like a house of cards. Simple as that. But from that single postulate, plus the one that squared numbers are equilateral geometries in the math of physics, those two postulates have given me everything that I've produced in tetrionics, have allowed me to explain these sort of things. But tetrionics is definitely a not just a physical theory or a geometric theory. It brings in so much from other fields, but you've got to have that understanding of what role the geometry plays. And by the way, I've fiddled with differing geometries, isosceles triangles, etc. But you can't build a proton using isosceles triangles. You can't build them out of hexagons. The moment you go past the three sides of an equilateral triangle, when you go to bring the polygons, say four, except for spheres, equilaterals, and squares, whenever you try to bring any five plus polygon together to form a solid, you end up with gaps. So you can't create a closed topology. So the only ones that can possibly work are circles and spheres, equilaterals and tetrahedra, or squares and cubics. The spheres and the cubics cannot, or to date haven't explained as much as what tetrionics has with the equilaterals and the tetrahedra. And by all means, if somebody wants to sit down and start working through squares instead of equilaterals or circles, like we've already tried circles, we've been doing that for the last 2,000 years. But if somebody wants to try and do the squares, I can think of immediately probably five problems that you're going to run into off the bat. Not the least of which would be, what shape would the electron be in relation to the proton and neutron? And how would they work? All these problems vanish with a little bit of electrical engineering, a little bit of mathematics, a little bit of geometry, a little bit of physical quantum theory knowledge, a bit of biology, a bit of chemistry, a bit of cosmology, and a whole lot of perseverance. It's one big melting pot. But you've got to go through the steps. Like I said, I'm probably remiss because I've put the two illustrations in there in QED and didn't bother explaining any further, because there's not a great deal more you can really explain about the process. It is what it is. It's just applying a small current or small voltage to an antenna in order to capture and enhance the signal. But that simple process gives us a lot of explanations, as you've just seen in this discussion. Where you are heading with the greater than and less than directional arrows equally applies with what we're doing here. Instead of drawing a pink arrow pointing outwards, you've got arrows pointing left and right in the arrow heads. And given the fact that the electromagnetic fields, as I say, creating them pushes momenta outwards in both directions. Once they're created, they draw energy momenta back into them. So if that's the picture there that we've shown in the last one, 2510, is the radiant field, the harmonically coupled field would have our arrows pointing in the opposite direction, but they would be much fainter arrows because they're weaker field strengths, but they exist all the same. The radiant fields just dominate what we can measure because they're the strongest fields around a particle. The field strength of the vacuum energy is minuscule, but it contains way, way more energy than all the matter, as I said. But from that basic explanation that we've just given and that you're starting to wrap your head around, as you said, you can see how EM fields, particularly BEM fields, couple with their environment. How not only electrons, but protons and neutrons and peptides and atoms and compounds and molecules and macromolecules, DNA, all these organisms not only broadcast their BEM field, but those BEM fields harmonically couple with their environment, which in turn give energy to the molecules. As I said, we're saturating our living environment now with microwaves on all sorts of frequencies, which will harmonically couple with, of all things, water molecules, which make up a huge percentage of our bodies. So the radiant fields of a H2O molecule broadcast out, have a weak field, but they broadcast out and they resonate and they harmonically couple with the Wi-Fi signals and the weak EM radiation floating around our environments. And that then gets drawn back in to make the atoms themselves and the molecules have more energy. Without the information and the coherence that should be there, this excess energy, the molecule doesn't know what to do with it. It's absorbed all this energy. What's it going to do? Well, it just says, well, I'll do what I've always been done, what I was designed to do. I'll keep making more copies of myself. And that's what it does do. And that's called cancer. It's just a rampant, abnormal growth of a cell. And it can be just many, many copies of the same cell itself, over and over for no reason. The reason's not vague. The reason is we're the frog sitting in the boiling water. We keep enhancing our environment with technology and EM fields of all types, and we're not thinking about how those fields are interacting with the biological organisms, i.e. our own cells. We got more concern for animals and how we do tests on them with radiation devices than we do for our own body and our own children, because we continue to saturate our environment. And worse, we now give our kids cell phones and laptops that expose them to more intense energy levels of the same radiation. So we need to take a step back and really look at how mass and energy couple together in biological systems. But that's all part and parcel of the biology work I'm doing. And we've got a huge amount of extra learning to do there. Huge amount. I've even made some progress on that in the last week, believe it or not. And amongst everything else. But it's tetrionics, I try and present it as a coherent, well thought out theory, but there's a lot of information that went into it and had to swirl around and be processed and extrapolated and played with and refined. And all these things come in together. They all interplay and interlock. This is just one tiny piece of that puzzle. One tiny piece. It just explains how particles get their energies when they're not moving. Where does it come from? It comes from the environment. Just like our body gets energy from the environment. We don't necessarily have to eat three huge meals a day in order to survive. You can go for quite a long time without eating three huge meals a day. So long as you adequately lubricate your body and give it water, etc., so it can continue to process like it's always been doing, it's amazing how much energy you can draw from the environment and how long you can do things beyond what your learned preconceptions are of eating and maintaining the body. But it does reinforce this strong interaction, which is where I think your interest is, Otto, with this biological processes of inanimate matter and biological life with the environment. It's all tied together. And the communication medium, the motivating medium, the thing that gives it life and motion, animates it, are mass energy fields, not inert matter. Take away the mass energy fields, matter just sits there and does nothing. It's at zero, absolute zero. No life is possible. No motion is possible.
Calvin, there's something else I'd like to pick up on. Connecting up to what you just said in the motion of life, one of the crucial things in life is that what we know is freedom of choice. In tetrionics, it would be at a level of being able to flip a quantum. In our body, we can see that it operates at the level of being able to open or close the boundary, to be a part of the universe or to be a part of the universe. Basically, the to be or not to be, that is the question in Shakespeare. And in that image of tetrionics 25.10, the resonant EM field, it basically puts next to each other what would be called symmetry and symmetry break in physics. Essentially, it is the function of the boundary. Is it open or is it closed? If you look at it at the deeper level, which is the most profound level that we can operate at, it is the choice of having a open boundary, which is known as a field, or a closed field, or a closed boundary, which we would call a boundary. And so in terms of the symmetry and symmetry break, if there is a if you focus on the boundary, then you will see that there is a symmetry break, because you can see the difference between the one side and the other side of the boundary, which in image 25.10 would be the quantum in motion with a specific direction, while if you focus on the field, then you're right in the middle of the boundary, so to say, which would be equivalent to the bottom part of the image, which would not be the boson but the photon, which would not be the particle in motion with the orientation, but the particle at rest with its expansion. And with what you described before, I now can understand how every particle is basically an attuned antenna, a pump by which the vacuum energy will be used in a specific way to either move the particle or the quantum, or to keep the particle or quantum in place and have it radiate out. So the kinetic equation of the particle in motion, or the radiant energy equation of the particle at rest, are basically the two perspectives which we can have on a part versus a part. And so at that level, in tetrionics, there is a very easy connection between symmetry and symmetry break, because as you said, the particle at rest will already create that radiative field around it, and then by interaction with other fields that can lead to the particle entering into motion. So symmetry and symmetry break would be the equivalent of a rest or motion. It would be the equivalent of a field versus a boundary. It also would be the equivalent to a part versus a part. And then, of course, image 25.10 also gives the clue to the principle of life, because that is where we tilt the balance between energizing ourselves at the expense of the environment, or energizing the environment in balance with ourselves. So if I look at the forms of health and disease, charging yourself at the expense of the environment is a force of disease. Charging the environment at the expense of yourself is a force of disease. But there is that elegant principle, which is essentially the transition from the subatomic particles into the particles, which in our body we experience as the first cell unfolding to make all of the cells of the body, that there are simple principles by which tetrions can accumulate energy and as a result can associate with other tetrions to form the subatomic particles, for example as the electron. As a result, they were better able to have that antenna function and accumulate and radiate the universal vacuum energy. But that then is also the principle which we see as the driving force of the cells. And health then is the balance between fueling up from the vacuum energy of the environment and being able to express, radiate out that energy into the environment, which of course is very much at the level of the link between consciousness and matter or mind and body. And so in this image 25.10, that in a way already has this key to understanding how freedom of choice works. The bottom part of the picture would be when you choose not to choose, which is basically building a potential, your capacity to choose remains undisturbed, it just expands. Basically you sit on the fence and you keep your options open, and the fence will continue growing in the environment as the environment expands. While the top part of the picture is basically to choose to choose, and then you will basically flip the quantum. You will choose to be part of the whole or to be a part of the whole, and that will determine your direction in the same way that amoebae in a food supply will move toward the food and away from its shit that it produces as a result of digesting the food. So in that image 25.10, that dynamic of freedom of choice is implied. At the top you see the quantum charged the one way or charged the other way depending on the choice that you make in polarizing your involvement, deciding to be apart and thus moving in the environment. And the bottom is where you identify with the environment, stay in it, and as a result grow in that. So there will be a possibility to translate 25.10 into the fundamentals of freedom of choice. But my starting point, as I mentioned, was more at the perspective of physics, that in this image, symmetry and symmetry break are immediately connected.
It can even go deeper than that, right? On the physics side, those that are more familiar with tetrionics would know that an equilateral chem field or a charge field is in fact an asymmetrical distribution of Planck quanta. It's a broken symmetry. That broken symmetry is restored when you bring two equilateral fields together to form a photon field. You get a balance of the positive and negative imbalance becomes then restored to a symmetric arrangement of plus and minus Planck quanta or plus and minus photons rather than the asymmetric bosons. So that if you have a if you think of it that way, you can say that the kinetic field is a broken symmetry versus the electrostatic field, which is a symmetric field or symmetry. And this is also carried through into the charged matter topology, which is your boundary layer. It's matter. It's no longer a EM field that permeates everything because of the huge wavelengths that are involved. It's now a very short wavelength, or de Broglie wavelength to be precise, boundary condition, which is matter itself. It's a closed volume. It reacts via these symmetric and asymmetrical fields with the environment to create not only freedom of choice, but also to transfer intelligent information about the particle and its motion and its properties to other points in the universe at faster than light speeds, near instantaneous, irrespective of the distance. The only thing that determines the distance of interaction between one particle and the other is how long those particles have been in existence. They radiate out. And as they radiate out, the longer that they've existed for, the bigger that field of electrostatic photons or symmetric photons with asymmetric bosons making them up. So that the boundary conditions there, the information's there in the field that you're looking for, all these things mesh in. But what you need first is that geometry. You have to stick with what the equilateral triangles can create. And then you have to try and re-educate your mind to look at what the geometry is telling you and how you can look at those fields and the arrangement of simple plus and minus charges to convey information and to get energy and to communicate things about one particle with the external environment and how in turn that environment can energize the particle and affect its motion, etc. So all these things are interrelated in very discrete and complex ways. But what's needed is firstly the geometry and then the perseverance to sit there and try to get your mind out of the original mindset and say, what is the geometry telling me? How do I make sense of this as to what it can and can't do? There's no virtual particles, there's no information, there's no computer at either end deciphering information. How does it convey it? And 9 times out of 10, which was our topics the other day, these fields convey information about the particle by virtue of their shape, their charge arrangement, and the forces that they can apply. Inversely squared, the longer the particles existed or the further away you are, the weaker the effects of one particle on the other. But as you get closer and closer, the effects become more and more manageable, more and more noticeable. And all this information is buried in that geometry. But you've got to look at things either transversely or longitudinally, or you've got to look at the force versus the momenta, or the velocity versus the momenta, or simply sometimes just the charge arrangement. The asymmetry conveys information. Even though it's asymmetrical mathematically, the electron doesn't care about that. The cell doesn't care about that. It just receives a certain amount of force in a particular arrangement of energy, a net force, a net charge, and it reacts to that. It's not interested in the fine quantum detail. But most particles just want to know about classical things. Where's the electric? How much is it? Where's the magnetic? How strong is it? How much force is being applied to me by this other particle? Am I attracted or repelled? That sums up a lot of the mechanics in tetrionics. There might be 1,500 pages, but when you get to know it, everything boils down to very, very simple processes. And that's how nature loves it. Simple to the better. So as we dig into this, we're bound to find some very simple and elegant explanations for some very complex processes.
Yeah. Delvin, I'd like to connect up on something which you briefly addressed before, but which is very crucial in the correlating between what Einstein said and what Tetrioni said. Your description was that in Einstein's approach there was this quest for understanding the difference between the electron charge field as circular or elliptic. Mm-hmm. And if you look at this image of 25.10, you can see that the circular charge is basically the image addressed, which is the diamond shape, while the elliptic is in fact a triangular shape. So that the translation of the elliptic versus circular in Einstein notation can be replaced by the triangular versus the diamond shape. And I think for many people it would be helpful to see that the translation is that simple. That if you, let's say, fuzz the view, if you don't focus the perspective which Tetralonics gives of the triangles and the diamonds, then if you sort of shake the triangles around, you would see it more as an ellipse. And if you shake the diamond around, you would see it more as a circle. But that there is this immediate translation possibility between the ellipse and the triangle and the circle and the diamond, which is basically saying that we are looking at bosons versus photons yet again.
Yeah, yeah. And it, but see, where relativity fails is because Einstein, after formulating E equals mc squared, thought to himself, well, the simple way to model all the dynamics, particularly in gravity, was to not worry about what's matter and what's energy and what's mass, just apply E equals mc squared across the board and not concern himself with the actual physical structure of matter and the things that arise from it, i.e. Resonant inductively coupled chem fields. And by just lumping everything into a general stress energy tensor, which is everything, mass and matter and energy are all just a energy density, he simplified some things but created a whole host of problems in ever advancing beyond that model. Because as they discovered, it's been a century now, over a century, since special relativity appeared, almost 100 years since general relativity appeared. And in all that time, we haven't advanced the theory any further. We've barely proven it within our own capabilities, and we certainly haven't unified it with either quantum theory or classical theory. We still have classical Newtonian gravity or gravitational formulas for 99% of the stuff we do. We only ever worry about general relativity if we want to be very specific about something. But the key in that Tetralonics gives us is the ability to differentiate between mass and matter. And in doing so, we rewrite the basic understanding of these electromechanical and electrodynamic processes. What the particles look like, the matter component, versus what the mass energy is making those particles do. In doing that, we then suddenly we can see the elephant in the room. We know its shape, we know how much it weighs, which direction it's moving. All these properties are there, as opposed to before, we just know that something is in the room. We can't see it, we can't touch it, but we know it has a certain amount of energy. And that's where relativity really fails, because special or general makes no distinction. Everything is energy as far as it's concerned. By putting form to the matter and understanding mass energy as a motivating force and a field, the spirit, if you like, of the universe, we can now use that geometry and that understanding to re-educate ourselves as to how things work. And it really is a re-education, because I don't know of any field that isn't untouched by Tetralonics, and yet in the same breath every field requires re-education. There's very little, even though the mathematics is the same and the basic tenets are the same, the light has been shone. The illumination of physics and science is now done. Somebody's finally switched on the light bulb and we can see these particles that we'll never physically see. We can see the fields of force and the quanta that make them up, their arrangements, how they transfer information. We'll never ever see them in reality either, because these are the bosons that make up the photons that we use to look at these things. We can't measure one system using photons without changing that system. So all these things interplay, but through the theoretical model of using a simple triangle, we can now flesh out the detail, shine the light, and re-educate ourselves into the era of our ways. There's so much more to learn. There's so much that has yet remains to be discovered and fleshed out. It really is. I'm going as fast as I can, as I'm able, and pouring out information. As more and more people come across and understand what I'm trying to convey and communicate, then things will start to be added and the snowball effect will take off. This is just the first turn of the snowball at the top of the hill. This is getting the information out and explaining it as clearly as I understand it. But every year, my understanding of tetrionics changes. I keep expanding my viewpoint and my understanding. So even something as simple as where Einstein took everything and said it's all energy, we now give it form. And we can see that the ellipses versus the spherical fields isn't really what's going on. In fact, they're not even circular or oblong or elliptical. They're in fact triangular. But in doing that and in seeing it that way, we get all this extra information about what's really going on. There's illustrations in QED where I map the diamond-shaped photons out from a distance from their source point, probably in around chapter 26, 27, something like that, in around the photons. Just looking, 2706 is a classic. I draw the equilateral triangles radiating out, but then I measure the field strength from the positive and the negatives and where the fields have collapsed and you've only got the magnetics, and I draw the lines circular because these fields radiate out in all directions. They're like one of those Christmas decorations that you get in the shape of a bell or a ball, and you loop it back around on itself to make a three-dimensional ball. All these fields radiate out in all directions. And from our physical perspective in the universe, reaching down to try and measure and determine what these fields look like, we just measure the strength of the electric and the magnetic fields. And in doing so, we get these measurements of mathematical values, of empirically derived values. And then we treat them mathematically to say, well, fields of similar strength lie at this point from the source, and we join all those dots together of equal value, and we end up with a spherical electric or magnetic field strength. And we say, well, they must be radiating spherical fields. Well, they're not. Those fields are in fact equilateral triangles radiating out. We're just misinterpreting the geometry that's at the heart of it all. And that's what I've spent all the time with tetrionics doing, taking that equilateral triangle and saying, what does it tell us about this and this and this and this? Chemistry, biology, physics, mathematics, even music, as you know. I mean, like, we just continue to apply the triangle, the Planck quantum, to various fields of science and artistry. And we come up with these answers. Even the religious and religious iconography pops up out of the triangle. So there's a greater message in the whole thing. And that message is that as much as the physicists of today say that mathematics is the language of physics, geometry is the grammar. Geometry sets the ground rules. It gives us the constants. It gives us all the values that we can perceive and not perceive, the material and the immaterial. But it's hidden from view because we never thought, or we developed tools of measurement and then we extrapolated what we perceived. And what's reinforced, as Einstein said, we're imbued with a set knowledge paradigm from the moment of birth, and our education reinforces it, and our experience reinforces it, because we think they're spherical particles, we measure spherical fields, the particles must be spherical, the planets are spherical, they go around the sun in spherical orbits or elliptical orbits. So everything to us over the centuries and in the millennia has reinforced this idea that as above, so below, so that we have the planets orbiting the sun, we must have electrons orbiting the atom, etc. And our entire preconceptions seem to have worked against us and reinforced this incorrect model. So you really have to break from that tradition, as Einstein said, forget about what you've been educated and look at what you can imagine, what you can rationally deduce. The difference between education and intelligence, so to speak. You have to step outside of your learnt knowledge and say, how else can this be explained? And in my case, I went, well, perhaps a triangle. Simple as that, perhaps a triangle. And from there, all this blew out. So, but it wasn't, even though the idea of just a triangle was simple, the relearning educational process has been non-stop and still ongoing. So every time you think of something that you think you understand, you have to look at it in terms of what the triangles will permit you to do. And in doing that, you come across some really crazy ideas. But sometimes you have some blinding insights, like suddenly I saw the magnetic fields on the surface of the charged topology of the electron. I could see that the north and south poles cancelled out. I could understand why we can't measure them or detect them. Even though they're there, we cannot detect them, because if you go to bring that pole close to the north and south neutralized pole, dipole, it pulls and pushes equally because they're identical but in opposite polarity. So our probes will never detect them, we'll never see them. They're far beyond our visual range or any device we could ever create in terms of measuring them. Now that we have that geometry, we have the ability to use our minds to produce real thought experiments and really begin to visualize what's happening at the quantum scale and how it creates the macro scale processes in cosmology and biology, chemistry, all those fields, the macro scale fields, are all impacted by what's happening at the quantum level. So there's lots of things that get restructured in your brain, or have to be restructured in your brain. And a lot of given explanations, you have to, as I've done, learn the explanations, look at the geometry and the topologies, say, what is that showing me? And even though it's completely different to what I've been learned, how can I make sense of it all? And as you know, the biggest struggles I had were not just QED. QED came together very quickly. The big ones were the chemistry, where I thought I knew what the shape of the atom was, and I thought I knew how the chemistry diagram should be right because we've used them for centuries, etc. But every time your perceptions are challenged by this geometry, it's unyielding. It just says, I am an equilateral geometry and this is all I'll let you do. I have an electric and a magnetic field and a square root linear momentum. From that, everything else is derived. If you can't draw me using those triangles, I either don't exist or you're completely misinterpreting what is really going on. And that's where the hard work is in tetrionics, because you have to unlearn everything that your education has taught you. And that's the biggest challenge in tetrionics, because it ends up, the more detailed I make it, the more foreign it becomes to people in the know, the people that have been educated. It's just a complete challenge to a mindset, to anyone's mindset, even my own. I still struggle at times looking at what it produces and how it explains things. And sometimes you get something, it explains one thing, and then completely contradicts the accepted notion of how something else works. And you've got to go off and really think long and hard about things, because it's never, ever like how we were taught. Except for, and I'll give credit here, except for, in most cases, the mathematics. The mathematics does marry up with the geometry, as it should do. But again, where we fail is our conclusions and our assumptions based on that mathematics. We assume that 4π fields are spherical. We assume that based on that, we should have spherical or circular fields and spherical particles. We make a lot of assumptions on the mathematics because there's nothing visual to go with the mathematics until now. We now have that. So there's a lot of things, as you know, Otto. We're working on a lot of stuff in biology. And I've got no doubt, given the amount of heartache that biology is giving me to nut out the end features, that there are big, big surprises in store there. As I said, even this week, amongst everything else that's going on, I've had some insights into that and the pinch reactor, etc. So there's always something bubbling along. The biggest problem with tetrionics is getting your head around the model. Once you absorb the model and understand the basics and re-educate your brain, some things come very quickly and easily, as you've seen over the years. Just you ask a question, I give an answer. The simplicity is there. It's a simple mechanism. But there's a lot of devil in the detail as well. You've seen how I can go on for hours talking about a small sliver of physics or biology, because there's so much information that this geometry allows me to elaborate on.
True, and there's something in language that's like when you have the holographic idea in your mind and you can only speak these words like a string of spaghetti one after the other to unravel that holographic image. However, then, of course, in tetrionics, you make use of that magic of a picture's worth a thousand words. So that already helps to get the connections in the understanding.
It's such a big key. Such a big key.
Yeah. What do you think? Is it a good place to round off this recording?
Yeah, I think so.
Let me just recapitulate. I was wondering how the particles and the fields are connected. We've already been exploring that in the previous and the foregoing sessions. This time you addressed a much deeper level of that understanding, which was that the tetrions, the fundamental unit particles in tetrionics, all have charged surfaces, but these charged surfaces have a magnetic polarity, which means that they can actually organize information, electromagnetic fields around them. And that in your story today was the crucial elements to understand how particles can radiate their signatures around them. Because the ambient vacuum energy field will interact with these structured quanta forming the tetrions, as a result of which that ambient electromagnetic field can be retuned and be charged as a radiant field around the particles. For me, it was really helpful to be reminded that this requires the insight of antenna theory, antenna functions, and maybe it might be helpful to enter into some detail about that at some later point. And with that understanding, then the particles can be seen to be receiving antenna plus also broadcasting antenna. They receive the white noise spectrum of the vacuum energy and they broadcast the signal of their own form, shape, forces and charges, as a result of which all of these particles can then interlink, interconnect, And that's basically something which we can then also see take place at a much larger scale as the communication between the cells that form our body, but also as the principles that form the universe as a whole. So that was, a really relevant, important contribution to you, your ongoing conversations about tetralis. And thanks again very much. Would you like to close it off in some way?
Look, anything I've already said in this discussion, that's the geometry. And the fact that everything boils down to mass and or matter. They're the essence of how tetrionics works. The rest of it's just re-educating ourselves on many, many different things that we think we know. And the work in biology is only going to give us more and more information on things that we hadn't thought of. And we'll see the merging of all these things. We'll see the merging of electrical theory with all facets of science, because everything is electromagnetic. What you learn in electrical theory to become an electrical engineer is crucial to understanding how nature works at the quantum level to produce all our macro scale effects. We just don't perceive it as electromagnetic to a great deal, because we've grown up thinking of it as biological, many of the processes. But over time, all these things are going to merge. Even the science and religion debate is going to become very blurred. It'll be no longer the clear cut, one's one and the other's the other, since Descartes' time. All that's going to blur as we, as a species, re-educate ourselves on how the universe really works. So, as I said, this is just one tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the puzzle. It only rates two illustrations in all of the 1,500 of tetrionics, which sort of sums it up. Mm. It's just a sliver, but from there, many fields of understanding can grow.
Wonderful. Calvin, thank you very much again. I'll close off this recording and, as usual, come back to you after that to evaluate. Yeah. And till then, thanks.
Okay.